Thank you very much. It's hard to top that introduction. You know, I wanted to start out by talking about one of the most generous benefactors of conservatism in California, Howard Amundson Jr., who's the son of Howard Amundson, who was a marketing genius who understood one great legacy of the Depression here in California and the nation, which was the insecurity about banking. And those of you who were here over the years noticed that we had home savings offices that were not the rented ground floor storefronts and office buildings, but magnificent standalone edifices. There's no place like home, the right-wing Harry Von Zell of Burns and Allen fame, and later George Fenner of Groucho Marx's Straight Man would say on television. Liberal Pat Brown was elected governor in 1958 and raised a fortune in campaign money from liberal Democrats who wanted approval of the valuable savings and loan charters. Hollywood liked the savings and loans, and long before Silicon Valley, offered the potential to develop here in California a new class of rich people without inherited wealth. I have here many, many examples, which we don't have time to share, about the innovation in California and the search for tradition simultaneously. People have always thought that New York was the leader in television, and even though Los Angeles was the number two media market, the three owned and operated stations here for ABC, NBC, and CBS always tested the most innovative techniques. We were the first media market with successively longer and longer newscast, and the first with then successively shorter and shorter newscast. The first to have the most substantive newscast, and the first subsequently to have the most sparse newscast. We were the first to have a bureau in Sacramento, the capital, and the first to do away with bureaus in the state capital. All news radio stations are given in major cities. We were the first to have an all news radio station. It was originally KFWB, a rock and roll station, the first all rock and roll station, and then that became the first all news station. We were the first with talk radio, Joe Pine. Any of you remember that? Well, the future of conservatism is affected by all of these things, and we don't have time to talk about them in detail. We tend to talk about politics rather than simply culture. And we have lots of organizations in this state, whether it's the Hoover Institution or the Claremont Institute, UCLA, which many of us affectionately know as Little Chicago because of its illustrious faculty, having been tutored under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, Pacific Research, Independence Institute, the Reason Foundation, the David Horowitz conglomerate. I could go on and on. And we have so many people who've come here after distinguished careers like Bill Rusher and Frank Shakespeare and Milton Friedman to retire, although Milton Friedman never quite retires. Our Henry Salvatore, whose death ended an era of ideological big givers to politics, and we've had some of the giants here who financed the conservative movement nationally and gave to National Review in the early years, gave $250,000 to Barry Goldwater before Bill Gates made such sums sound trivial. Mr. Salvatore and his fellow tycoons launched the Reagan candidacy for governor at the California Club, where some of you will be meeting tonight. They met in 1965, not long after Goldwater's crushing defeat. Now that's optimism, to elect as an actor as governor, and that's long before Warren Beatty. Here in California, we launched the careers of two presidents, Nixon and Reagan. Nixon, who disappointed so many of us with his heretical support of wage and price controls, kept the Soviets off balance with what many of us saw as a sellout of the nationalist Chinese. And yet it was Nixon playing chess on an international board and Reagan then playing poker, raising the stakes so high that the Soviet empire eventually crumbled. But Reagan's personal style left the Republican Party here in an ambiguous state because his following was largely personal. We never mustered strong leadership or sustained success at the state legislative level in Sacramento or at the congressional level in Washington, D.C. The single dominant figure in Republican politics in California for the last two decades was not one of us. I speak of Pete Wilson, very much of a Nixon tactician. California, though, is not a state that has occupied a progressively larger and larger space on the national electoral map that presidential candidates have viewed as essential to win or to lose. It's a state that has spawned a lot of ideas, many good ones. The contemporary tax limitation movement that Ed Meese alluded to really started earlier, but in 1978 with Proposition 13, which limited property taxes in two ways. First, property taxes could not exceed 1% of valuation at a time when property taxes in this state were running as high as 3% of valuation. Your property tax bill, secondly, could not increase from one year to the next by more than 2% at a time when increases were double digits. Now, if you believe that Republicans took control of the House in 1994 because of Newt Gingrich and not Bill Clinton, then you believe that Proposition 13 occurred because people were reading Milton Friedman. Remember this fact, Proposition 13 was probably destined to lose, like Howard Jarvis's other statewide measures, except for two occurrences. First, reassessment notices were, with huge increases in assessments, were mailed out a few weeks before the election, and that was a very boom period in California real estate. And secondly, it was revealed that California state government had a huge multi-billion dollar surplus. Now, since Proposition 13, liberals have learned not so much to cut government, but to raise revenue in very different ways in this state, and that's another subject. Now, just as Proposition 13 spawned successful measures to limit property taxes in other states, and Sally Pipes mentioned this earlier, and Proposition 209 has started that movement, we also saw that the Republican Party in this state often was behind the curve and not ahead of the curve. The Republican Party was slow to support Proposition 13. Pete Wilson, for years, suffered from the fact that he'd opposed Proposition 13 that year. Evel Younger, the eventual nominee, supported Prop 13, but Jerry Brown was so skillful at reversing positions that polling that same year in 1978, by the time the general election occurred just a few months later, showed that more people thought that Brown supported Prop 13 than that Younger did, even though Younger had supported it and Brown had led the campaign against Prop 13. Now, in some ways, issues and political personalities are intertwined, and let's look back. Consider the two United States Senate seats. One seat, which is held by that intellectual powerhouse Barbara Boxer, was held in the early 60s by liberal Republican Tom Kuchel, who was defeated in a primary by then State Superintendent of Education Max Rafferty. In that same 1968 general election for president that Richard Nixon won, Rafferty, who seemed to scare voters with his fire and brimstone style, was defeated by a liberal iconoclast, Alan Cranston, who was a leader of the California Democratic Council. Cranston had been discredited just a few years earlier as California state controller by appointing tax appraisers who contributed to his political campaign. After winning over Rafferty, he became a master of constituent service, especially to Republican businessmen, including conservatives there. He voted liberal but sounded moderate in his radio sound bites and was everywhere on television and radio. He was reelected three times, the first time post-Watergate 1974 against H.L. Bill Richardson, an affable conservative who sought to construct a preposterous coalition of gun owners, hunters, fishermen, recreational vehicle owners, and evangelical Christians. The second re-election campaign for Cranston was in 1980, a strong Republican year in which Ronald Reagan was elected, but Cranston defeated Paul Gann, the lesser-known half of Jarvis Gann. Like Richardson, Gann ran an inept campaign seeking to capitalize on a much narrower born-again Christian base at that time that was hardly even solidly Republican. The third time in 1968, Cranston barely defeated U.S. Congressman Ed Chau, who in turn had defeated Bruce Hershenson in the primary. Shaw was a good campaigner, but fell victim to Cranston's dirty tricks, which funded a supposedly independent expenditure negative TV ad campaign at the end. Finally, in 1992, Cranston was no longer viable, given his cozy relationship with savings loan tycoon Charles Keating, himself a one-time crusading conservative anti-pornography leader, who had headed Citizens for Decency Through Law, whose chief spokesman and an employee was Bob Dornan, just before Dornan had ran for Congress. This time, Bruce Hershenson was the nominee, having defeated Tom Campbell. Hershenson fell victim to Democratic dirty tricks at the end and a faltering Bush campaign. Finally, last year, the same Senate seat, 1998, Boxer defeated State Senator, State Treasurer Matt Fong, who ran a very lackluster, underfunded campaign bereft of ideas. What can we learn from the Boxer seat? Max Rafferty, Bill Richardson, Paul Gann, we ran variously conservative candidates who lacked money and an appealing presence and made little use of television and radio media advertising. Chau and then Hershenson would have won absent the dirty tricks, and in Hershenson's case, he was harmed irreparably by the Bush concession of California essentially months earlier. But Hershenson himself was a TV creation, the sense that he had been on television for years, and even some voters who were not hardcore conservatives were attracted to him personally and said, I don't agree with him on everything, but essentially, I applaud his genuineness, and he's so different than most politicians. Fong's television advertising, in contrast, featured his mother asking people to vote for him. Fong had defeated Darrell Issa, a businessman who ran a silly campaign, who, after Michael Huffington had spent $30 million, boasted about how much money he would spend. So it wasn't really a rejection of conservatism. Let's look at the other Senate seat, the jinxed Senate seat. Political expert Tony Quinn reminds me this is the historic seat of the late Hiram Johnson, historic figure, who led the fight against the League of Nations, who joined the Bull Moose ticket in 1912. Now in 1958, we had a real crazy situation in the state. Governor Goodwin Knight and U.S. Senator Bill Nolan decided to run for each other's offices. And at the same time, they decided to have a right-to-work initiative in California. A real sense of hubris. The initiative energized the opposition. Knight lost the governorship to Attorney General Edmund G. Pat Brown. Nolan lost the Senate race to Claire Ingle, a veteran California politician first elected to the California State Senate in 1942, the U.S. Congress in 1944. Now it was 1962, 4 years later, after Governor Knight had lost the Senate race, after Senator Nolan had lost the governorship to Pat Brown. Pat Brown was reelected, now defeating Richard Nixon, who was trying for political comeback. Now, parenthetically, after Nixon lost the governorship in 1962, all political pundits said his political career was entirely ended. Now we go back to the Senate, where Claire Ingle was there, and there, just in his first term, he was now suffering from a brain tumor, but he refused to withdraw from the primary. Eventually, he did die in a few short months later, and Governor Brown appointed JFK Press Secretary Pierre Salinger to the jinx seat. Salinger was there but a few months and lost to actor George Murphy. Keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this was in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was trounced by Lyndon Johnson and George Murphy won. Was Murphy a conservative? In many ways he was, but he won because he was considered a nice, genial guy. Consider this, that same year we had something on the ballot called Proposition 14, which was very similar in the matter of so-called fair housing to the Colorado measure on homosexuality that the U.S. Supreme Court overturned. The Proposition 14 would not only have rescinded the Rumford Fair Housing Act, but in effect would have prevented any similar legislation anywhere in the future, anti-discrimination housing legislation. Now, two things are noteworthy about that year. One is the Los Angeles Times, to show you how much has changed, actually strongly editorialized against Proposition 14 in favor of property rights. The Times, in effect, supported a flat prohibition on fair housing legislation in perpetuity. Now, George Murphy, to show you how times had changed, was asked his position on the most pressing issue of the day. And he said, "Good heavens, Americans have fought and died for the right to a secret ballot. I wouldn't think of telling you how I would vote." And that answer was accepted. Now, Murphy, of course, again held that same Senate seat for only one term once again. It was 1970, and he lost because, among other things, he had been accepting money from a conservative, Pat Frawley, there on a consulting contract while serving the United States Senate. He lost to Congressman John Tunney, who later became Bruce's sparring partner in KBC. Tunney, of course, the son of the boxer, not a wrestler. Now, that was not all that liberal a year. That was the same year Bill Brock won in Tennessee and Jim Buckley won in New York. 6 short years later, John Tunney, again, only one term, served only one term, was defeated by Sam Hayakawa, a Republican, the same year that Jimmy Carter won the presidency, 1976. Now, what was noteworthy about that year is I remember seeing polls and nobody believed how it was that Hayakawa was going to win the primary because he hadn't been doing anything for several years. What happened is in the late 60s, you may recall that this short president of San Francisco State College went to some thugs that were on campus there and he seized the speaker from them. And that event was so memorialized in the consciousness of people that his identification in polls remained at a high level for 6 and 8 years later. So running a very simple campaign, he won. Now, unfortunately, he tended to fall asleep in the United States Senate, and so he served only one term. And it wasn't until Pete Wilson in 1982 broke the spell of the jinxed Senate seat, and he won a multi-candidate Republican primary only because he was the only one with a base in San Diego. Not much of a base in the state, but better than no base at all. But he was elected November not so much because he was Pete Wilson or because of his campaign, but his opponent was Jerry Brown. And by then, we had just finished a recession in California, and so the Jerry Brown small is beautiful, limited growth philosophy was largely discredited. Wilson was blessed with another weak opponent, Leo McCarthy, the Assembly Speaker, 6 years later, and was able to then be elected for a second term, finally, for that seat. 2 years later, he ran for governor, and he won against Dianne Feinstein. Elected governor, his Senate seat was vacant. He appointed John Seymour, who was bland and colorless and a crony, and in addition, a moderate Republican. Seymour could energize no one and was easy for Feinstein to defeat. So she had run in 1990 for governor, 1992 for Senate, and 2 years later ran the third time in a statewide race for the election to the full term and defeating Michael Huffington. So what we're seeing in California is that the voters tend to go more for personality than for issues. When we have a moderate Republican who loses, conservatives say it's a moderate Republican. When we have a conservative Republican who loses, moderates say that. But in point of fact, we find that issues have often played second place to people's perception of an individual. Bruce Hershenson, very conservative, came very close to winning, absent some dirty tricks at the end, and the albatross of the Bush campaign around the neck of the Senate race in this state. Voters rejected Nixon in 1962 for governor because they felt he was more interested in running for president and he didn't have a credible candidacy. Ronald Reagan won in 1966 and 1970. And Reagan essentially took the same position that Murphy did on disclosure in certain issues. Murphy refused to state his position in Proposition 14. Ronald Reagan was asked in 1996 about his position on the John Birch Society, and he refused to take an active position there and simply said that if people who were in the John Birch Society wanted to support him, they were accepting his ideas. He certainly wasn't accepting their ideas. Jerry Brown won because he was partly blessed with bland, moderate Republican opponents. He defeated state controller Houston Flournoy in 1974, and I hesitate to say this in this room, but an academic, and State Attorney General Evel Younger in 1978. Now, Duke Majan was not an exciting candidate, but he defeated Tom Bradley twice, in 1982 and 1986, and the first time was largely technical. He lost on all the ballots cast on Election Day and won with absentee ballots because it was the first year Republicans mastered the way to change the turnout by having large numbers of absentee ballot mailings. 4 years later, by that time, Duke Majan had the benefits of incumbency. Wilson, in turn, had run a better and more conservative campaign than Feinstein in 1990. But having done that and being elected governor, he repudiated his conservative base completely. And in 1994, an underfunded conservative challenger, Ron Unz, in just a campaign lasting a few weeks, spending as much money as someone would run for Los Angeles County Supervisor, received 34% of the vote. Gray Davis, as mentioned, ran a disciplined centrist campaign, and Lundgren, which Ramesh said I ought not to say, was hailed inexplicably by National Review as the next Ronald Reagan on its cover. But he wasn't Ronald Reagan, and he isn't Ronald Reagan, and not only did he lose badly, but he helped bring down a Republican the state legislature and the Congress. And I think public personality was very much of an issue. Now, I would like to talk very briefly about some of the issues in the state before I conclude and look toward the future. There is a libertarian and a traditionalist strand of conservatism that I think needs and was blended together by George Murphy and Ronald Reagan with a personal following. There also is a social conservatism among the state's very rapidly growing Latino population, but that population, rightly or wrongly, feels so disengaged from the Republican Party that they're simply unable to look with any dispassionate view at all toward that party's position on issues. Proposition 187, in the way in which it was marketed in such a way as to cause some harm. Those of you who were here recall the Pete Wilson television spot that was, they just keep coming. And long after the spot had achieved its point and moved sufficient voters over to the Wilson camp continued showing the spot over and over again, day after day, week after week after week. Now, the Conservatives made quite a start with Proposition 209, but again, the Republican Party ran away with the issue and never embraced it in a principled way. Proposition 227, the same situation there. The Republican Party tends to be so clumsy in its attempt to exploit issues that it loses any possible principled position. It's not taken seriously. I think that what we need to do looking toward the future is to go beyond a knee-jerk support for big business and to really be entrepreneurial. I think that we need to, in a state that has Silicon Valley, strongly support a self-regulating internet and not a government-regulated internet. I think we have to take a quasi-populist view in that in this state, like in many others, but particularly here, we have government at all levels providing all sorts of subsidies to corporations and big business. And I think what we need to do is to oppose those subsidies for urban redevelopment and shopping malls and football stadiums and all the rest. I think when it comes to criminal justice, I think that we need to look away from the discredited policies that are imprisoning so many people in our jails and prisons for drug offenses there. Indeed, the most powerful public employee union in this state outside of teachers are prison guards today. I think we need to show a greater appreciation for civil liberties while advocating the strongest possible penalties to lock up violent criminals. We have issues like school choice, but we moved prematurely in 1993 with a measure that was not fully crafted and was lacking sufficient funding. And I believe the 1993 school choice voucher measure, in retrospect, did more harm to the movement than good by affording the teachers' union statewide, nationwide, an opportunity to spend over $20 million in discrediting the idea of school choice, at least for a decade in this particular state. I reject the view that the future of conservatism in this state is held hostage to demographic trends that favor minorities and youth. I believe that the demographic drop in the white population was due to a reversible exodus to nearby Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, and Washington, as the Los Angeles Times recently published, and economic conditions are changing. I don't think the future of conservatism in this state is bleak. I don't think it's also, it's not Pat Buchanan. I think, like nationally, it rests in an optimistic and future-oriented entrepreneurial vision that emphasizes opportunities of the marketplace and the need for civility in a very, very changing environment here. Thank you.